Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington.
And I'm Nabil Biagio, also in Washington. Here are some of the stories we're covering today, Wednesday, November 12, 2014. The U.S. welcomes progress at the Sudan and SPLM North talks.
We signed the declaration of Addis Ababa, which includes that the opposition and the government should stop hostilities and ceasefire.
And residents of Yei stage a demonstration after several mysterious deaths in the town.
Tomorrow is going to be me, so I don't know where our life is leading to, and we don't know where South Sudan is leading to.
We will have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The U.S. State Department says it welcomes face-to-face talks between the government of Sudan and rebel groups from Darfur, Blue Nile, and the Nuba Mountains to end the fighting in those areas. The talks opened today in Addis Ababa. The U.S. and other Western nations have been expressing deep concern about the conflict and humanitarian crisis in the three areas and call on the leaders in Khartoum to commit to reaching a peace deal with the rebels. In a statement released yesterday, the United States, the United Kingdom, and Norway, known as the Troika, say peace talks between the Sudan government and the Sudan People's Liberation Movement North and the Darfur elements of the Sudan Revolutionary Front are, quote, a critical step towards both the resolution of ongoing conflicts and a comprehensive process of national dialogue that can address the range of issues that have fueled Sudan's conflicts and political unrest, end quote. Sudanese Information Minister Ahmed Bilal says the government delegation sent to Addis Ababa and headed by presidential aide Ibrahim Gundur has a clear agenda to reach an immediate cessation of hostilities agreement for Blue Nile State and the Nuba Mountains.
We signed the declaration of Addis Ababa, which includes that the both parts, the opposition and the government, should stop hostilities and cease fire. So negotiations about ceasing fire will start today in Addis Ababa.
Bilal says the rebel leaders in the three areas need to lay down their weapons and engage in a peaceful national dialogue to resolve the issues that have fueled the more than three-year-old civil war in Blue Nile and the Nuba Mountains.
They will have all the guarantees to come inside the negotiators. From their side, they can come to Sudan and we start to go, the dialogue. If we could reach an agreement or something like that, okay, otherwise they will go back.
But Sudanese political analyst Haj Hamad in Khartoum says the government demand that the rebels must put down their arms before starting a national dialogue presents an obstacle to achieving any lasting peace deal.
The government is insisting that they should have a permanent ceasefire and that they should go and negotiate the surrender of the army and a DDR program for them. And then after that, we will look at the political agenda, which looks very, as I said, it's a quite polarized situation.
Hamad says without enormous pressure by the Troika and the African Union High Implementation Panel, the talks will not yield the desired results because the government has a stronger military than the rebel groups.
The government is feeling that they have a very strong military situation, position, but at the same time, the political elite and the ruling elite are well protected. And they think that they're negotiating from a position of strength.
Hamad says the U.S. needs to put pressure on Sudan to agree to a partial humanitarian ceasefire.
At least to put such kind of very essential life-saving children immunization, giving civilians a window of opportunity to restock their food, especially Dura. I mean, there is a need for an acute humanitarian situation is brewing, and I think the government is using food as a weapon, and they are refusing a partial ceasefire.
The statement is strongly urging the parties on all sides to show their commitment to peace by coming to the Ethiopian capital this month to be prepared to engage meaningfully on all the issues identified by the African Union Peace and Security Council in September. The civil war erupted in 2011 after the separation of South Sudan and Sudan. The rebel groups say they are fighting for their economic and political rights.
From Khartoum, we move to Central Equatoria. The killing of the former mayor of Yei Town, Cecilia Oba, has angered residents and civil society activists who are asking the government to investigate what they claim is an increase in acts of brutality and general insecurity. Officials are arguing calm, but citizens say they can't wait for protection. For VOA News, Ochan Hannington has this report from Yei.
This morning in Yei, Hawa Adam and about 50 others held a peaceful demonstration expressing dissatisfaction with their government in the wake of the murder of former Yei County Mayor Cecilia Oba. The demonstrators say people are increasingly worried about the security situation, which they insist is deteriorating more and more each day. One young protester encouraged the crowd. There is insecurity in the country. Where shall we go? Police and all other security organs help us to stop unnecessary killing. Although Cecilia Oba's mother was the catalyst for today's event, Hawa Adam and the other demonstrators believe local government officials have not done enough to protect them from what they call an unnecessary death.
Today it has been hard time, but tomorrow is going to be me. So I don't know where our life is leading to, and we don't know where South Sudan is leading to. So that is our worry.
Hawa is a citizen of Yei County and a teacher by profession. She and about 50 other demonstrators walked all around the town for about 4 hours. They are grieving what they insist are the mysterious deaths of several of their fellow citizens, including Cecilia Oba. The group delivered a letter containing their grievances to Deputy Mayor Silvano Ali. They are demanding, among other things, that the killers are brought to justice. They also want an official declaration of a mourning period for Oba and the others who have been killed. And they are demanding that security nationwide be strengthened. At today's event, Deputy Mayor Ali asked those gathered to stay calm as authorities search for clues to track down the killers of the former mayor.
Our citizens of Yei, we are all saddened to this sad news. What happened to Oba in particular is unbelievable.
Oba was found dead in her unfinished house in Jebel along the Yei-Juba road together with her private secretary, Emmanuel Lemi. It is believed the two died from stab wounds. These types of unsolved killings have increased in recent months and have outraged citizens. It is what prompted the Yei Civil Society Organization to mobilize citizens to take part in today's demonstration. The organization's General Secretary, Dara Felix David, explains.
At the same time, we are also using this demonstration to inform our government, the people in authority, the SPLA and the police, that they are not doing enough. We need people brought into account. We need that our people can spend a night with a lot of hope of seeing tomorrow. South Sudan is changed.
The Yei Civil Society Organization intends to keep the spotlight on this issue. David says the group will form a committee to work with the police to ensure that the perpetrators of crimes are brought to book. And he says his organization is ready to head back to the streets if officials fail to do their job. For VOA News, I am Ochan Hannington in Yei.
Stigma and discrimination against people living with HIV, as well as denial by some South Sudanese living with the disease, remain obstacles in the fight to stop the spread of HIV and AIDS. Charlton Doki recently visited an HIV treatment center in Maridi and has this report for VOA from Juba.
27-year-old Sabur Samson sits pensively at the HIV treatment center at Maridi Siva Hospital in South Sudan's Western Equatoria state. Samson has come to collect her medicine. She says she tested positive for HIV 2 years ago and has been on treatment since then. Samson says the community discriminates against people like her. Speaking in simple Arabic, she says some people in her community fear being in contact with people living with HIV. She says there are some who will greet her, but others will not even enter her house. 32-year-old Kamis Mongo smiles as he chats with other patients at the treatment center. Mongo says he tested positive for HIV 5 years ago. He too says people discriminate against him because of his HIV status. Speaking in simple Arabic, Mongo says there are some people who choose not to greet him because he has HIV. And he says others will not eat food from the same plate with him because they think they will contract HIV. Mongo says some children even laugh at him on the street. Susie Luca, a clinical officer at the treatment center, confirms that people living with HIV are discriminated against, even by loved ones.
Even if HIV is an old disease, people know about it, but still the community have discrimination and stigma. Sometimes if a patient is having, the status is now positive, the family will not be comfortable and they discriminate and they give a lot of stigma. They chase away the clients.
Nearly 1,000 people living with HIV have enrolled for treatment at the Maridi Center. 795 of the patients are being treated with antibiotic cotrimoxazole. Luca says most of her patients are women.
You know, men are tricky. They like to send their women to go and test. And then some even send them their wife to go and collect the medicine for them. So they are more like they are having more stigma than the woman. That's why you get a number of women, there are many than men.
But stigma and discrimination against people living with HIV is not the only obstacle to fighting the pandemic. As it is elsewhere in South Sudan, poor access and continuity of services remain challenges to reducing the rate of HIV in Maridi. Luca says many patients live too far from the clinic for regular treatments or follow-up care.
Most of the time, we receive clients from different locations like Rasulu, Iba, Baraulu. So all the Payams around Maridi, we are getting clients from there. So it is hard for them to travel from there up to here. So we are missing to follow up our patients. We are losing our patients because it is hard to travel from far to up to the clinic.
On top of being HIV positive, many patients are not getting enough to eat. The UN says despite help from international aid organizations, millions of South Sudanese remain food insecure. Mongo says HIV-positive patients who don't get enough to eat are weaker. Speaking in Arabic, Mongo says some people living with HIV don't have money to buy food. Mongo wants non-governmental organizations to provide HIV patients with food. He says he has seen other HIV treatment centers like the one in Yei, where patients are provided food items including cooking oil, beans and flour, and he says it makes a big difference in their treatment. Luca says healthcare workers have tried to encourage communities to support people living with HIV who are unable to feed themselves, but few are willing to do so.
They are supposed to support those who are sick, by even contributing some small food, even if it is not cash, but at least food, so that just to make the patient comfortable and to gain the health. But it is still hard, you know, for you to contribute food to somebody which is not from your family. It is, for some people, they cannot understand it.
For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Juba.
VOA Africa presents a message in the public interest from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control.
It's difficult to recognize Ebola because the signs, sudden fever, diarrhea, vomiting, are shared by other diseases. It's quite difficult for anyone, except a healthcare worker, to say definitively, yes, it is Ebola, or no, it is not Ebola. So if you have sudden fever, diarrhea, or vomiting, and you have been in direct contact with someone who is sick, you should go to the health center, because no matter the cause, you can receive help there. And remember, with the right information and together with our healthcare workers, we can protect ourselves from Ebola.
That was a message in the public interest from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control, brought to you by VOA Africa.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, the future for education in the disputed Abyei region. Don't go away. That story is coming up next.
South Sudan in Focus listeners can find us on the following shortwave frequencies: 11900, 13870, and 15180 kilohertz. We're also on the web at www.voanews.com/South Sudan, or download our podcast on iTunes. That's South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
should corporal punishment in schools be abolished?
It should be abolished because there must be a principle that guides education in a particular country, because the education system must be put in priority, and those who are teaching should follow the principle of teaching. They should, for example, they should not cane pupil beyond.
Yeah, it should be abolished since some teachers take advantage and really hurt some students.
Yeah, it should be abolished because why should we have corporal punishment? The schools are institutions for teaching and learning, not to punish.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
Many schools in Abyei are standing empty and unused. It's been that way since May 2011, when Sudan armed forces clashed with the SPLA in Abyei, a disputed territory that has been under United Nations administration since 2008. Some of the students fled out of fear after the violence, while others were displaced from their homes. Jacob Echek recently spent 3 days in the area and has this report from Juba.
Alor Dolbiet is the Director General of Education in Abyei. He said the majority of the nearly 2,700 pupils who attended school in Abyei before the violent act dropped out. He said a key reason for the high dropout rate is rapidly attacked by Syrian militia, who are loyal to Khartoum.
From time to time, there is a fear. Syrian attack and militias attack Abyei is affecting the learning process. Schools in Abyei town are supposed to work or to be operated, but now we have only one primary school is operated because the status of Abyei. The school was crowded last year, 2013. We have left now with only 423 pupils in this school in Abyei. But when Makir crisis happened, most of the children and parents, they evacuated the town.
Dolbiet said there is another reason why some students abandon their studies, and that is the fact that English has been made the language of instruction of Abyei. Many students in the area are Arabic speakers. He said around a third of schools in Abyei have shut down since the violence in May 2011.
We have 43 primary schools, but 27 are functioning due to the May crisis. The rate or the outdrop rate is high because of the May crisis. In the very beginning, we used to have 3 secondary schools, and now we have got one, only with 980 students, and they are studying in Agog. All of them, they are kept in one school.
Many residents of Abyei town flew south to South Sudan border area after the violence. Some ended up in Werab State and Awil East in northern Bahr al-Ghazal. Abyei Youth Representative Reg Ado Reg said many of the children who flew Abyei are now living in the street. Others are in camp for internally displaced persons. The lucky ones have been taken in by relatives. He said many of the Abyei displaced children are not getting an education.
when the war, you know, displaced the population in Abyei town and some part of north of River Kyiv, it was difficult for children to get access to education, and so it caused trauma in them. And right away, many children are on the street because they are seeking survival. And the parents, some of them lost their parents in the war, and so nobody is taking care of them. Some are already in the other states, for example, where up, wow, and they are not accessed to education.
The May 2011 fighting between the Sudan Army Forces and SPLA in Abyei has been followed by other bouts of unrest. Among other incidents is the killing last year of paramount chief of the Nyingok Dinka tribe, Leif, in Abyei. Wani David, a teacher at Agok Secondary School, said few children returned to school after the chief was killed.
During the crisis, we had the students in the school by then, but when we resumed the studies, more than half of the students never turned up to date. They never turned up. So after the crisis, that is what happened. So we have an overwhelmed number of students in the school as a result of the fear of going back to Abyei.
Adding to the problem faced by Abyei school is the fact that thousands of people have fled from neighboring Unity State during the current crisis in South Sudan and have sought shelter in Agok in the south of the Abyei area. Many people who fled the violence in Abyei also sheltered in the Agok area. The large influx of people fleeing violence has added more strain to the already struggling education system in Abyei. The Abyei administration has contracted several foreign teachers, mainly from East Africa, to try to help Abyei area improve its educational system. But a key step toward getting children to go back to school would be a restore peace in Abyei and in South Sudan. For BOA News, I'm Jacob Achek in Juba.
You are still listening to South Sudan in Focus. Traditional stories from around the world are providing insights into how ancient women survived war. The oral stories tell of women developing strategies to protect themselves and their children. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
Whether it was centuries ago or today, women have suffered greatly in war, even though they are usually not combatants. Stories passed down through the generations indicate they use their wits to make the best of terrible circumstances. Michelle Scalise-Sugiyama, an anthropology instructor at the University of Oregon, studied those stories. They come from North American Indian tribes, the Eskimo of the Arctic, Australia's Aborigines, the San of South Africa, and tribes in South America. She says both indigenous people and anthropologists agree that hunter-gatherers pass down their knowledge by telling tales, not by writing them down.
My main interest is the role that storytelling has played in human evolution and how far back it dates in human prehistory. And the basic argument that I make in my research is that it dates back thousands of years, tens of thousands of years, to when all humans on the planet were making their living by hunting and gathering. So I just started asking myself, well, what kinds of information does it take to make a living as a hunter-gatherer? What are some of the problems that they face on a regular basis? And warfare is one of those problems.
She says there's a lot of research in evolutionary psychology on warfare and when it emerged in human prehistory. But she says there's little information on women and war through the ages.
The research focuses on men because warfare is primarily waged by men, especially in forager societies. Women are victims of it. They defend themselves, but they don't really participate in attacking other groups. The research is focused on why males would be motivated to engage in this behavior, what the possible benefits are, and how male psychology has been shaped to enable males to engage in warfare.
Scalise-Sugiyama says oral histories provide long-term patterns of behavior that archaeology, for example, cannot provide. She says more men die in war than women, but adds that women are affected by war in many ways.
Death in violent interactions is not the only potential cost of warfare, especially in the case of women. Women are often taken captive, and children too, whereas men are more likely to be killed. They don't tend to be taken captive. So that just started me thinking about the different ways in which warfare affects women.
She gives an example of how women in the midst of war could react.
If a woman was taken captive and she wanted to escape, well, one really useful piece of information would be what the terrain is like between the enemy village that she's been taken to and her natal village, the village that she's trying to get back to. You have to be able to find your way back. Another set of useful information would be, well, how do these different enemy groups living around me, how do they treat their captives? Do they tend to adopt them into the tribe and treat them like group members? Do they torture them? Do they rape them?
So, would it be better to fight her attacker or go along as a captive, knowing she would not be killed? Another possible strategy, she says, is the use of sex by women to escape.
Women are typically taken as wives, so she'll pretend to like her new husband, and then when an opportunity to escape arises, she will typically engage him in very vigorous sexual intercourse to tire him out so he falls into a deep sleep, and then while he's asleep, she kills him, or sometimes her husband kills him. Her husband may be in on the escape attempt, so he'll sneak into the tent after the captor has been exhausted, kill him, and then he and his wife make their escape.
The anthropology professor says the so-called Stockholm syndrome may have ancestral roots. It's when hostages bond with their captors during abusive conditions.
When I started researching it, I was surprised to discover that there's actually no validated criteria for diagnosing it, and it's not recognized as a psychiatric disorder or condition by the medical community. And so that suggests that it might actually be a coping mechanism or a coping strategy. It may increase the captive's chances of survival by motivating her to identify with her captor and adopt his views and the views of his society so she can fit in this new society.
Skelly Sugiyama says she wonders what the psychological state might be of hundreds of girls kidnapped earlier this year by Nigeria's Boko Haram militant group.
When women are taken captive, they're put in this really difficult position, which is you don't know if you're going to be rescued or not. So you don't know if you're going to spend the rest of your life in this new society in which you're basically an enemy, an outsider, or if you're going to manage to get back to your natal group, you know, your own people.
She says the research could lead to better social and psychological help for women affected by war. The findings appear in Springer's journal, Human Nature. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
That's our show for this Wednesday. We now leave you with the song Associé by Congolese superstar Fally Ipupa.
Table noir, pour tous les jours, yo, sokolaka, na banana, poussonne, yo, tchatcha, tessina, y'a si, y'a mon imondo qui n'est retard, na pou fanatika, y'a salavine, y'a. Sommet de sommet.
Pour les robins au Kamanga, les ménages d'Ambola, la chemise en plein hiver. Benako Toko, Nyoso. Bon, je t'aime, Royona, l'obé la kio. Et le qui conjugue, j'en veux me donner, n'a bien mon bon année belli.
Mon cliché en verso.
Bien, vous allez retourner à mon témoin.
Opéra sommet.
We have been listening to Fally Ipupa with that song, Associé. I can see some people dancing in the studio here. I'm John Tanza in Washington.
And I'm Nabil Biagio. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.